Morning, everybody. Happy Mother's Day to all you moms and all you who celebrate moms. We are studying Ezekiel. This is week number 6. And I got in there to the copy machine a little while ago and it said, unable to make copies. So I had to unplug it and plug it back in. That's what you do with electronic stuff. That's the extent of my knowledge. Maybe. I couldn't tell you. Oh, my sister. She's doing very well. She's home. And I asked her about how things were going. She said she's in no pain. That's the main thing. So she had a surgery similar to the one I had. Well, probably exactly like the one I had with cancer of the bladder. So she's home doing well. Thanks for asking. Ezekiel chapters, what did I do? 7, 8, 9, 8, 9, 10, 11. 4 chapters we're going to cover this morning. Hey, dog. I don't know how we're going to do it. But I felt pretty sure we needed to talk about these 4 together before we move on to number 12. But here's the question to review at the top. Number 1, so far as you see it, what's the big picture God's given us through Ezekiel's visions? The overall picture, what is this all about? Put it in your own words. It may not be just exactly like I have it and doesn't have to be perfectly worded, but what's the big picture? How do you see Ezekiel fitting in to the Bible and to the plan of God? Okay, the Israelites are rebellious.
And he's trying by letting God speak through them to help them.
Trying to give them some help, get them back on track. Very good. Anybody else? I hope that's not because you're just at a loss as to what Ezekiel's all about. What does the word, the name Israel mean? What's that? He who struggles with God. That's what Israel means. Struggling with the Lord. Struggling with God. God changed Jacob's name to Israel when he wrestled with an angel. And ever since this nation has been a nation, they have struggled and wrestled with God back and forth. They want their way. He wants his way. He set them up as a nation for what purpose? One purpose. He's going to bring his son into the world to be the savior of humanity, the savior of mankind. And he needs a nation to do that. This was his plan. And as a people, they keep rebelling against God. And God is showing us through them, through his working with them, how much he loves humanity, not just Israel, but all of humanity. And how much he expects them to do the right thing and to be punished when they do the wrong thing. And what's happening is kind of an unheard of thing. A nation goes off into captivity. What did God say was going to happen in 70 years? He's going to bring them back, which is exactly what happens. They come back, they rebuild Jerusalem, they rebuild the walls, they rebuild the temple, they rebuild everything and reestablish themselves as a people, paid for by Cyrus, the Persian king. All that's future to Ezekiel, but these are the things that God is pointing his people towards through Ezekiel and through Jeremiah and through other prophets, talking about how God is working out his plan in spite of their faithlessness, in spite of their evil, in spite of their violence, in spite of their abominations, in spite of their idolatry. God is working his plan for the salvation of humanity through these rebellious, stiff-necked, flint-headed people. Remember, God said he was going to make Ezekiel's forehead as hard as flint because this is a stiff-necked and rebellious people. And so he's working this plan out in spite of them. That's kind of the overall picture as I see it. So number 2, in relation to that, how would you answer the who, what, where, when, and why questions with regard to prophets, peoples, places, times, causes, etc.? Who is involved in this? The obvious given one is Ezekiel. Who else? Israelites. Specifically called in Ezekiel, what are they called? In this case, who's he talking to? This name, this word, this description comes up time and time again. The exiles. The exiles. They are Israelites, but they are in exile in where? In Babylon. So that's the where. The why? Name the sin. That's pretty much how it goes. Name the sin. They've been involved in it. Violence, idolatry, depending on other nations instead of God, unfaithfulness. When did it start? Anybody got a date from anything we've looked at? It's 606. That was the first deportation in 606 BC. So we're talking 600 years before Christ comes in the flesh. God's taking his people off into exile. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't happenstance. This is what God was doing through Babylon to punish his people, but also to preserve his people so he could bring them back in 70 years. What's going on? Haven't seen you guys in a while. Looking good. So, what have we missed there on the when and why and where? I think we got it all covered. All right, one of the most tragic sections of the Bible. That's what I wrote in there, chapters 8 through 11. Anybody got anything? All right, I need somebody to read 1 through 6 of chapter 8. Who would like to do that? Any literate person will do. All right, Matt.
In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I sat in my house with the elders of Judah, sitting before me, the hand of the Lord fell upon me there. Then I looked, and behold, a form that had the appearance of a man. Below what appeared to be his waist was fire, and above his waist was something like the appearance of brightness, like gleaming metal. He put out the form of a hand and took me by a lock of my head. And the Spirit lifted me between earth and heaven and brought me visions of God in Jerusalem, to the entrance of the gateway of the inner court that faces north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy which provokes to jealousy. And behold, the glory of God, the God of Israel, was there, like the vision that I saw in the valley. Then he said to me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north. So I lifted my eyes toward the north, and behold, north of the altar gate in the entrance was this image of jealousy. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me far from my sanctuary? But you will still see greater abominations.
Thank you, Matt.
Where is Ezekiel when this chapter begins? And you can look at the text. That's okay. That's not cheating. He's home. He's in his own house. Where's he been previously? What strange thing had he been doing because God told him to out in the streets where they were living in exile? Laying on his side, doing what? Playing war. That's how I would describe it. And who was he playing war against? Jerusalem. Had a brick with Jerusalem inscribed on it. And everybody walked by and see him out laying in the streets, playing war against the city of Jerusalem, showing them how God is going to exercise his wrath against the city because of their rebellion. But now things have transpired and he is in his own house and he says the hand of the Lord is on him. All right, first bullet point under that section. What's the time reference given here? Fifth day of the sixth month, but with reference to what? I would look back at the first chapter. Yeah. Look back at the first chapter. This is how time references usually work in the scriptures. First verse of Ezekiel says, it came about in the 30th year on the fifth day of the fourth month while I was by the river Chebar among the exiles. The heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. What does the 30th year refer to probably in this case? It's Ezekiel's age. When did a priest begin to minister as a priest? When he was 30 years old. That's when he would begin his priesthood, and Ezekiel was a priest. But then in verse 2, it says, on the fifth of the month in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's exile. So in chapter 8, we're almost certainly referring to the sixth year of King Jehoiachin's exile. The visions began coming to him in the fifth year. Now he's talking about the sixth year, giving us a time reference or a time frame for what's going on here. And then where was Ezekiel when the vision came to him? We've already answered that. He was in his own house, probably on a cul-de-sac. A nice little cul-de-sac in Babylon, somewhere by the river Chaldees with a view. Who was with Ezekiel? The elders of Judah sitting before me, having an elders meeting right there in his house. What had been placed at the north of the altar gate? Okay, and he doesn't get specific. What was the image? What was the idol? It doesn't say. Why do you think God put that in there? Why do you think he's having Ezekiel record that this is something that is seen? And what's significant about where it's being seen? Ladies, you're out doing some shopping and you see your husband walking around with another woman. What happens? Well, guys, you're out running errands and you see your wife walking around with another man. That's not supposed to happen. God is showing Israel, you are causing me to be jealous, righteously jealous. This isn't about God being petty. This is about God's right as God, seeing his people worship other images, other gods, other spirits, anything besides himself. So he's not specific about this. He doesn't need to be, because this is an image set up that causes jealousy. And then God tells Ezekiel, well, this is the last bullet point. God was to show Ezekiel still greater abominations. That idol was an abomination. It was in that place where God alone was supposed to be worshipped. Only God's supposed to be worshipped anywhere, but especially in the temple. And here in the temple, they have set up an idol that drew people away from God. All right, chapter 8, verses 7 to 18. That's a little bit lengthy, so let's just take a quick look at it here. Verse 7 says, he brought me to the entrance of the court, and I looked, and behold, there was a hole in the wall. And what did God tell him to do? Dig through the wall. What did he see when he got through that hole in the wall? He saw all the abominations that the leaders of Israel in the temple were committing against God. It says in verse 10, I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved where? Carved on the wall. They're not just hanging pictures or hanging tapestries of these gods. They are carving them into the walls of God's temple. How permanent is a carving? Pretty permanent. Pretty permanent. And that's what they are doing. And then it says in verse 11, standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel, with Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand, and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. What were these men not doing? This is telling us some of what they are doing, but what are they not doing?
They
Okay, they're not worshiping God, and they are not stopping the idolatrous worship going on. They are not putting those things out of the temple. These are 70 of the leaders of Israel, and they have censers in their hand, but that incense is not for God. Verse 12, Son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark? What do you normally do in the dark? Things that you're afraid to do in the light. Things that you don't want to be seen, or things that are associated with the dark. It doesn't say here, it's not specific, but God is saying, you see what they're doing in the dark? And that never, hardly ever talks about anything good. Each man in the room of his carved images, they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. And then what does God tell Ezekiel in verse 13? Going to show you worse than this. What could be worse than that? The leaders of Israel in the temple before carved images doing in the dark things, and they say, God won't see us here. This is the leadership of the nation, the leadership of the people. We have a unique arrangement in our nation. What's that? They were aware they were doing wrong. And if they weren't, they should have been. And those elders are the ones, the very ones, who should have been setting things straight. We elect officials. We send them to Washington. Probably because we don't want them around here. No, that's a joke. But they represent us. That's the idea. And then they lead the nation. They're supposed to represent us. In our nation, we select leaders to represent us, and they are supposed to be servants of the people. In Israel, at this time, the leaders were supposed to be the ones who guided the people. Our leaders are supposed to take their viewpoints from us. This is what the people say that elected me and sent me up here, and this is the way I'm supposed to be governing according to what the people back home want. But here, the leaders were really supposed to be the leaders, the ones who knew best, the ones who would say to the people, this is the word of God, follow this. But in this case, they're saying we're following idols. We're going to do it in the dark. We don't even think God's present with us, and he even doesn't even see us anymore. And God says, I'm going to show you things even worse than what you're seeing here. Verse 14, he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. Behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. They weeping for God? No, weeping for Tammuz. He said to me, do you see this, son of man? Yet I'm going to show you what? Going to show you even worse and worse and worse. He just keeps saying, I'm going to show you worse. Verse 17, do you see this, son of man? It's too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they have committed here, that they have done what? Filled the land with violence. All right, you want to worship idols, you want to go off in the dark and honor Tammuz and light your incense, that's one thing. But when your practice of false religion causes you to abuse my people, fill the land with violence, you've crossed the line. Any violence in our political situation in this country? Always look to the ones who are committing the violence and for the purpose behind it to get a clear view of what's going on. That's what God is showing Ezekiel here. Verse 18. Yes.
This image he puts in the last of 17.
Okay.
They are putting the twig to their nose.
I tried to find out what that was all about. There's no real accurate commentary. But here's the idea that the people I would trust the most, whose opinions I would trust the most, say. They're looking toward the east. The sun is rising. And they are holding up the twig because they don't want their breath to diminish the glory of the rising sun. What was the sun called in the creation?
Sun.
Do you remember? Think back on the first chapter of Genesis. What did God create to rule the day? Did he call it the sun? The greater light. The greater light. Did he call it the sun? He did not call it the sun. He called it the greater light to rule the day. What did he create for the night? The lesser light. Here's a good bright light you can use to rule the daytime. Didn't even give it a name. Here they're giving it a name and they're worshiping it. They're bowing down to it. This is a greater abomination than the ones before, but it's like abomination after abomination after abomination. Foolishness after foolishness after foolishness after foolishness. Sometimes you will see people who get into trouble through no fault of their own. They lose a job. They were working hard, but something happens to the company and it gets shut down. You lose a job. You're on hard times. Your car breaks down and whatever. Other times, why do people get into trouble? In English, we would say, they're stupid. Can you say that in a Bible class? Don't look around the room, but have you seen people in your life who get into trouble for God? This is what's happening here. This is not, they're just accidentally falling into the, they're deliberately departing from God. Just like when somebody cheats in a marriage, that doesn't happen by accident. Now, it might be gradual, but every point of graduality you look back to, there's some intent that takes place. There's some deliberacy. Nobody gets into an affair in a marriage, or outside a marriage rather, by accident. Oh, I just didn't mean for that to happen. Well, at some point you did. In another point, you did. And another point, you did. What could have happened anywhere along the line? Could have been stopped. Could have said, whoa, 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 this, no, I'm not doing this. Same with Israel. And God uses that imagery. Remember Hosea? What did God tell Hosea to do? Go marry a harlot so the people can see through your relationship with her what my people are doing to me. And that's what God's talking about here in chapter 8. All right. We haven't even filled in any of these blanks. What did Ezekiel see when he dug through a hole in the wall of the temple? I think we've already covered that. Three times in this chapter, God told Ezekiel that he would see even greater abominations. Beyond the religious abominations, God said the Israelites had filled the land with violence. Because of these things, God said he would have no blank in his wrath. No pity. No pity. It finally got to the point where, nope, you're getting it. All right, 9, 1 through 11. This is one of the most significant chapters in all of Ezekiel. Somebody read for us the first 6 verses. Is that... No, the first 8 verses. Who'd like to read the first 8 verses? Got to read? Okay, Brandy.
Then he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. Behold, 6 men came from the direction of the upper gate which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case at his loins. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Then the glory of the God of Israel went up from the cherub on which it had been to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed in linen at his loins with the writing case. The Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. But to the others, he said in my hearing, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women. But do not touch any man on whom is the mark, and you shall start from my sanctuary. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. And he said to them, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. Thus they went out and struck down the people in the city. As they were striking the people, and I alone was left, I fell on my face and cried out, saying, alas, Lord God, are you destroying the whole remnant of Israel by pouring out your wrath on Jerusalem?
Thank you, Brandy. All right. Whom did God call to draw near to the city? Executioners. Other translations have destroyers. What was the one with the inkhorn supposed to do before the destroyers began their work? Put a mark on the... How would we call... How would we say those people? How would we describe them? Righteous people. People who cared about what God thought. People who were upset because of what was going on around them, all those evils. When Peter writes about Lot in 2 Peter, he said his righteous soul was vexed by all that he saw going on around him. Where did Lot live? Sodom and Gomorrah. And his righteous soul was vexed. It's the same thing here. When you and I are upset when we watch the news and we see the evil that's going on, especially when we see evil being perpetrated by people who should be leading, who should be guiding, who should be representing, that evil hurts us. It doesn't simply make us mad. It goes deep within our soul and makes us wonder how long until the Lord decides to come back. And that's the kind of thing happening in the world today. But it's always been happening. And here it's happening with the specific nation that God has created to bring his son into the world and save us. Third point in that section, where did the glory of God go before the destroyers began their work? The threshold of the temple, right there at the entrance. Where and with whom did the destroyers begin? Started right there in the temple with the leaders of the people. Repeating himself, God says he will have no blank, no pity, no mercy, no more clemency. And that he was bringing their blank upon their heads. This is the same principle he's repeated earlier. They're going to be judged according to what? According to their deeds. That's what God has said through Ezekiel already. You're going to judge them according to their deeds. However they behave, that's how the judgment's coming. You're going to get it according. And nobody knows better than that, better than God, how to get that accomplished. It's a great comfort to me when God says, do not take vengeance for yourself. Why? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. He sees it all. He sees it happening to you. He knows who's doing it. He knows why they're doing it. And he is promising us, Marty, I'm going to take this in hand. You do not need to strike out a blow for vengeance. I will take care of this. As a matter of fact, vengeance belongs to me. It doesn't belong to you, Marty. So just rest assured that I'm going to take care of whoever is persecuting you, whatever is happening. That's his promise to us. So we don't have to worry about taking that kind of action. But he's saying, and in this case, vengeance against people who are insulting him and cheating on him. Observations, questions up to this point. I know we're covering this pretty fast. All right, 10, 1 through 17. And this is a very detailed description of the movements of the, anybody want to venture to fill in that blank? Cherubim, however you want to pronounce that. The IM denotes plurality. And the im, if you say with the im, that sounds a lot more Hebrewish. So, I don't know. That's how I've always said it. Do you ever wonder about that? You say a word a certain way all your life, and then somebody, oh, don't you know that's pronounced this way? And you go, I'm an idiot. I've been doing that for decades. Titus.
I do actually have a question.
All right.
What little children?
What good is it to what?
To kill the little children.
That's a good question.
I don't understand that. The Lord is just and righteous, so there's nothing for it, but I just don't, hard for me to wrap my mind around it.
What are we seeing here? Right. But what is Ezekiel seeing? Is this literal or is this a vision? It's a vision. It's representative. But what's going to happen when the Babylonians come? They don't care about age. They're going to wipe out little children just as well as the old. It's as if God is saying, do you not understand that you're bringing evil not simply on yourself, but on your entire nation and every little child that's part of this nation? And what's their future going to be like? God is trying to get us to see what evil does. And how many times has your heart been broken when you're watching the news and you see little children being abused? There's a couple that are in the news right now, killed a 9-year-old. It's like, what? And it wasn't somebody got angry and hit him. This was abuse over time that the little guy finally succumbed to. It's like, just let me have vengeance one time, Lord. Just this time. If these kinds of things anger you and me, what do they do in the mind and the heart of God? And he sees the big picture. He's working it out. What does he know he's going to do in 70 years? I'm going to bring the remnant back. What is he concerned for when he sees in this vision the people being destroyed by the destroyers? And even who else is killed along with the evil in the vision? What happens to those who get the mark? They die as well, but they die with a mark. Makes all the difference in the world. Remember, this is a vision. This is representative of true things that are actually happening. So the question is relevant. What about these little children? By the way, when you go back in history, and there aren't always explanations for this, what were the Israelites supposed to do when they went into Jericho? What was supposed to die in Jericho? Everything. Every man, every woman, every child, every animal. If it breathed the breath of life, it was going to be wiped out. Who knows a little bit better than you or me the disposition of all those who were put to death on that day? A little child is put to death by an Israelite. Does God know where that child's going to go? What's going to happen to them after death? We're talking about God who's sovereign, not just here, but he's sovereign in the spiritual realm as well. What would have happened to those little children if they'd have grown up in that culture? They would have been turned into hell almost certainly because of the influence of that culture. And so God says, I know who these people are. I know everybody who's in there. You think there were any children in Sodom and Gomorrah when the fire rained down from above? And there were not how many righteous people? How many did Abraham work God down to? If there were at least 10, God, would you spare it? And God said, if there's 10, did God know how many there were? Yes. That's not 10. That's 10. I would never forget in math. If there's 10 people, I'll spare the city. There weren't 10 people. So everybody in the city died except Lot and his wife and his two daughters. And unfortunately, she looked back and she became a byword. Lot's wife. That's all you have to say. Those who look back. And then Jesus comes along later and he says, if you put your hand to the plow and do what? You look back, you're not fit. What were these people doing in Ezekiel's day? They were looking back. They were looking all around. They were looking anywhere, anywhere but God. And that's what we're hearing in so many quarters today. We'll do, anything's okay as long as it's not God. You want to kill a baby? Yeah, sure, you can kill a baby. We'll find a way to justify that. You want to marry a man wants to marry a man? Yeah, you can marry a man. That's no problem with that. We'll find a way to justify that. But you say, well, here's what the Lord said. Well, what are you talking about? That's crazy. Religion. What is wrong with you? You are twisted. You're a psycho. Want to talk to us about God? But if you said, well, now here's a religion that teaches this. They think this prophet came down on a flying horse and he wiped out half the people of North Africa and went up and was conquering Europe until they finally stopped him. But that's a peaceful religion. The first war that our nation ever declared was against five Islamic states in the Mediterranean. Go back and check your history books. You ever heard of the Barbary Pirates? Well, pirates are cool, aren't they? No, pirates are not cool. Pirates are murderers. Pirates are thieves. Pirates are slavers. And they were destroying our ships, stealing our goods, and enslaving our sailors for years. And Jefferson finally said, we got to do something about this. We're going to form this unit of fighting men called the Marines, and we're going to send them over there. So we sing the Marine hymn from the halls of Montezuma. How far over? To the shores of Tripoli, North Africa. That's a religion, Islam. And everywhere it goes, it brings death and conflict. Now, there are Muslims that are fine people. But they're not stopping the ones that want to kill us. Nobody in this nation gets out in the streets and chants death to Islam. But you go in a lot of these countries and that's what you hear, death to America. This isn't a diatribe against Islam. It's that Islam represents, in a way, what we're looking at in the Old Testament, a departure from God, an embracing of a religion that people will see the evil of it and they'll still go ahead and say, oh, it's fine, it's peaceful, it's good. We need to allow this. We need to bring this into our nation, our culture, and let it change everything. And I think people are finally starting to wake up to what's happening. But if you try to take God, we don't want nothing to do with no God that's the true and living God. It's crazy. But this is what's happening in Israel. The exact same thing. All right. Chapter 10. What's going to happen in chapter 10? What's going to happen in just a minute? The bell's going to ring. Somebody read for us the first five. Well, no, let's not do that. That's going to take up time. Yeah, the first five verses of chapter 10. Who wants to read that? All right, Jake.
Then I looked, and behold, in the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, something like a sapphire stone in appearance resembling a throne appeared above. And he spoke to the man clothed in linen and said, enter between the whirling wheels under the cherubim and fill your hands with the coals of fire between the cherubim and scatter them over the city. And he entered in my sight. Now the cherubim were standing on the right side of the temple when a man entered, and the cloud filled the inner court. Then the glory of God went up to the cherub, to the threshold of the temple, and the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord. Moreover, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks.
All right, Jake, if you would skip over to chapter 10 and read verses 18 and 19, please. Yeah, same chapter, just 18 and 19.
Okay. Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth and the side with the wheels beside them, and they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of God of Israel hovered over them.
Thanks, Jake. All right, and in that first section, the one at the bottom of the page, says this portion of Ezekiel's vision describes the movements of the cherubim, the angels. the movements of the cherubim as the man clothed in linen. Remember him? He had the inkhorn previously. He took coals from the fire, or coals of fire from between the cherubim, and did what with them over the city? Scattered them. Do you remember Ezekiel was told to shave his hair with a what? Use a sword to shave your hair. And then what are you going to do with the first third of that hair? Going to burn it. Burn a third of that hair. Then what do you do with the other half or the other third? Chop it up with the sword. What do you do with the last third? Scatter it everywhere. This is the same kind of thing going on here. It's God re-showing us this is what's happening. I had this guy mark everybody who's righteous, everybody who cares about me. So all the righteous people are marked. I know who they are, but I'm sending my destroyers in spite of those who are righteous because there's not enough of them to save the city. What did he say? Even if, now this is later in the text, even if Daniel, Job, and Noah were in the city, it wouldn't be enough to save it because of the evil that's going on there. And what happens in verses 18 and 19? The glory of God departs from the temple. I'm out of here. I'm gone. I will not dignify this place with my presence any longer. And when God leaves, his destroyers go out. The coals of fire are scattered over the city. God does not leave without bad things following. And that's what we're seeing here. Here Ezekiel sees in his vision the blank of God departing from the blank, glory of God departing from the temple. Our time is gone. I don't want to get into these next or this next two sections, but this is the close of this particular section. We'll sort of get into a transition in chapter 12, so we'll come back to this next week. But what we're looking at is the rulers being judged. James said, be not many of you teachers. Why? Because if you're a teacher, you're going to have a stricter judgment. More is required of you if you take a position of responsibility or authority. Is that supposed to scare people away from doing that? It's not the intention. What's the intention? Why do we have an inauguration to say to everybody, okay, this guy's our president, whether you voted for him or not, he's our president. What are we supposed to do for leaders? Supposed to pray for them, not badmouth them. Even if you didn't vote for him and you don't like him, you're not supposed to badmouth him. Pray for them. That's what the scriptures teach us to do. And let God be the judge and be the ruler. One of the things we learn about Daniel, by the way, where was Daniel? Daniel was in Babylon. He went with the first wave. Ezekiel's coming in the second wave. Daniel is in Babylon, and he says in chapter 4, because God is going to depose Nebuchadnezzar from being king temporarily. You may recall that pretty colorful thing that God does with Nebuchadnezzar. He turns him into an animal, and he goes about on all fours eating grass, and his fingernails grow out like claws. But when God restores his body to human wholeness, what else does he restore? Puts him back in the kingdom in charge. And that, what? That happened to him and nobody took over? Nobody grabbed the kingdom while he was being an animal? No, it didn't happen because God didn't have it planned that way. God put him in position. And in chapter 4 of Daniel, we read, God sets over nations the basest of men. He's always done that. He's still doing that. So when you look at a president, don't look at him to be the guy that you would hire to be your preacher or appoint to be an elder or a deacon. That's not the point. God is putting men into positions. You look back at every single president this nation has had, and I believe God is the one who appointed each man to that position. Maybe he appointed them according to what the nation wanted. We wanted to vote this guy in or that guy in. Was an election fair? Was it rigged? Maybe so. But if God's the one who appoints leaders, maybe that's the way God wanted that to happen. There's a lot of evil in the world, and God is still setting up people who are base men. But what are you and I supposed to do in the thick and the thin of all of it?
Saul had him anointed, and he told him what was going to happen. Here's what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And same God.
Same God. And we still do it. We still want a king. Oh, you're going to warn me about having a king? Well, I still want a king, God. So that's the way we are. Thank you. Appreciate your time and patience. We'll come back to Ezekiel next week, Lord willing.